Hello and welcome to this special Christmas edition of Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Catherine Haddon, IFG Senior Fellow and consumer of far too much television. But then, let's face it, who hasn't resorted to excessive binging of Netflix in the past couple of years? Because we've all had quite enough reality in our lives and we've all been at home rather a lot. And now, with many again facing Christmas in self-isolation and an uncertain January, and the NHS facing another Herculean effort, our thanks to all of them, we thought we would try and take your minds off it with something a little bit different. That's right, it's the return of our now official annual look at what fictional and fantasy worlds can teach us about government, and what the IFG would be writing reports about if only the screenwriters would give us a cameo. Fans of this podcast will remember that last year we discussed Darth Vader's failure to outsource construction of the Death Star, the urgent need for Ofsted to pay some attention to the safety record at Hogwarts, and whether a police and crime commissioner should be elected to sort out the quite ridiculous murder rate in Midsummer. And this year, we've got some absolute Christmas treats on the menu, taking you into a parallel world of fictional spies, cartoon pigs, and prime ministers who enjoy dressing up in slightly ill-fitting police uniforms. Okay, maybe not the last one. But I've got a great panel with me to help ruin your enjoyment of yet more TV shows and films. Back in the virtual studio again is IFG senior researcher Alice Lilly. Hello, Alice.
Hi, Kath.
Most important question to you, first of all, have you actually finished the last season of Succession? Because if not, I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
So controversially, I actually haven't. But but before you kick me out,
yeah.
I've read detailed plot synopses for the last couple of episodes.
I mean, that's a shame, but
I know.
But on the other hand, you've got the joy to come. So
exactly.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. And with us again is Gavin Freegard, IFG Associate. Hello, Gavin.
Hello, Kath.
Now, Gavin, data has had a very busy pandemic and you love data. Yesterday, the FT's data guru, John Burns-Murdoch, tweeted, "Too much data, help." So, you know, just as a welfare question, how are you coping?
Well, I think the issue has always been that it's a bit like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. There's always been too much data and not enough all at the same time. You can sometimes get completely overwhelmed by it. But, you know, the answers to some very basic questions, and you'll have heard me swearing in the office frequently about how many civil servants does this department employ? Or what is this department spending its money on? Sometimes that basic information still isn't there. So I know this is about films rather than poetry. But yes, maybe a Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner data special at some point is what we need.
Oh, okay, fine. Plug for a new podcast. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Patrick Kidd, diary writer at The Times. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, Kath.
Patrick, presumably Christmas party season is a boom time for diarists, so how's that working out?
Well, in normal times, I suppose it would be. I've still been going to the odd super spreader event, trying not to get Omicroned, but... in fact, actually, in light of what I'm going to be talking about later, I was tucking into roast suckling pig at the Savile Club last night. So just so
spoiler
I would be able
alert.
To talk about pepper.
Yeah.
But yes, no, it's all a bit muted this year, but that's good too.
Yeah, but number 10's been giving us plenty of stories about parties, so at least making up for it that way. Okay, so to begin, we turn to a world in which infighting is rampant, factions are ever-changing, everyone is vying for the top job, and the memes keep on coming. Alice, surely you've had enough of talking about the House of Commons, right?
Well, you see, Kath, it's funny you say that, because, as you know, I am a firm believer that there is a parliamentary angle to everything in life. And I think that actually Succession, and very specifically the marriage of Shiv and Tom, basically tells you everything that you need to know about how the relationship between Parliament and government in the UK works.
Ooh, intrigued.
Yeah, I think this might be one of the worst takes that I've ever come up with. But,
okay, go with it. Keep going.
Just keep going. So, you know, if we think back to something that Tom said, he's reflecting on his quite troubled marriage with Shiv, and he talks about them having an unbalanced love portfolio. And that's exactly how Parliament and government work. Because if you think about it, it is a little bit like a troubled marriage. You know, Parliament and government have to work together. That's for the benefit of everybody. Government needs to get its business through Parliament. Parliament needs to hold government to account. But they also have their own interests, and there's a real kind of tension between the two of them. And that's exactly what we see between Shiv and Tom in a take that I think is basically guaranteed to upset everybody.
Okay, but which one is which then?
So I think Shiv is the government in this scenario. Mm. Kind of closer to power, is more naturally involved in decision making, you know, very much got the kind of like power turtlenecks and trouser suits. And Shiv needs Tom, i.e. Parliament, to provide a bit of support to her. But she takes him for granted, doesn't really think about his feelings, doesn't really think about his interests. And so you've got Tom as Parliament, you know, he has to make that bit more of an effort to try and get involved in decision making. Structurally, that's not easy. He's not always taken very seriously. He seems to feel kind of quite keenly a desire to do what Shiv, i.e. the government, wants. But, you know, ultimately that has its limits. And without, you know, giving too many spoilers away about the most recent episode, Tom is a reminder that Parliament, if pushed, can have a little bit of a sting in its tail.
Yeah, yeah. It's very much some humble address vibes in the most recent episode.
That is the most IFG sentence anyone has ever uttered.
I know. Yeah. Okay, Patrick, I want to bring in you on this. Very pleased that you were able to join us, and to make you feel really welcome, we chose to talk about a show that you actually haven't seen. A, why? And B, is it now a point of principle? Everyone's sort of going on about Succession, so you don't want to know?
There is a bit of that. I think I try and avoid the zeitgeist as much as possible. So I've never watched an episode of Game of Thrones. I never watched Breaking Bad. What else is... I was called recently and asked if I could write a piece about the new series of Sex and the City, because they assumed that in my 20s I would have watched it originally. So I said I've never watched an episode of that. I do watch television, but with two small children, it largely involves cartoon characters. Or what I've been particularly enjoying is the series on the Bill Clinton impeachment. But I just want, is Succession effectively I, Claudius remade with sharper suits?
And a lot of swearing and, you know, insults and so forth. I mean, I guess so. It is kind of those basic tropes of power and politics and so forth and who rises to the top. But I think the reason people want it is there are some fantastic one-liners in there, some fantastic development and relationships. And the screenwriters do like to just send us in completely the wrong direction and then suddenly do a massive U-turn in the plot. So it always provides some drama. But yeah, in these troubled times, you know, why we would turn to more drama, I don't know, but for some reason we do.
But particularly a dynamic about, as I understand it, about families vying for power, as the name would suggest. You know, I wonder whether we think of our own Johnsons and whether history, if it had gone a different way, might have had a Prime Minister Rachel or even a Prime Minister Joe, or perhaps they just didn't have the ruthless touch to get ahead of their big brother.
Well, I mean, if you're pitching for series of the future, I'm sure somebody will be contemplating the Johnsons and how to make something out of that. But yes, it's one of these ones, isn't it, that people still love as much drama as possible in their lives, even when what's going on in the outside world is kind of, you know, perhaps a bit too much drama. Well, Patrick, then we asked you to come on here and tell us about the shows that dominate your life and give us some insights into government. So tell us, what have you got?
Well, this is topical as well as reflecting what I spend most of my time watching. But it's about snouts in the trough. So there is a political angle here. And I'm talking about Peppa Pig, of course, which... Yeah. Poor Wilfred. I have no idea if Wilfred Johnson is a fan of Peppa Pig. He keeps being taken to it, to Peppa Pig land, and then he went to see the play at the Haymarket recently, and his father mentioned Peppa Pig in his CBI speech. Wilfred might hate the thing, as far as I know. But there's a lot of political interest in Peppa Pig. The Labour Party in 2010 tried to co-opt Peppa to come and promote their Sure Start scheme. And in the end, the makers pulled her out, thinking that they didn't really want to take sides. And Jacob Rees-Mogg is a huge Peppa Pig fan. You would have thought that perhaps he'd gather the children together and put them in front of something racy, like Lord Clark's Civilization or something. But no, he told me that he is a big fan. I think partly, he said, it's because he likes the idea of jumping up and down in muddy puddles, which is a big thing in Peppa Pig world. And when I discussed this with him, knowing that we're both have classical interests, I worked out that the Greek for jumping up and down in muddy puddles is telematopodesis, which I was delighted that Mogg then said that word at the dispatch box the following week when someone asked about what exercise people should be taking. Yeah. And he said, the Times tells me telematopodesis. And so that is a one-off called a hapax legomenon, as they'd call it, in Hansard, for which I'm totally responsible. So I'm delighted about that. Now, in the Pepper world, it seems to be an idyllic form of government. No one does much work. Hmm. They all have huge houses on hills, big cars and things like that. But they don't actually do anything. I mean, Daddy Pony is an optician. Daddy Zebra is a postman. Dr. Elephant's a dentist, but you never really see them working. Mr. Fox is a sort of private Walker spiv, and we need to look into his tax records. But the main characters, Mummy Pig is clearly a journalist because he just spends all day playing games on the computer. And Daddy Pig is apparently an engineer, but he is always home in time to pick the children up from school, which is very confusing how this society has evolved. Mm. However, there is one very, well, there's two hardworking characters in this. There's Dr. Brown Bear. I'm assuming you know all this. But
I have watched Peppa Pig, yeah.
Dr. Brown Bear, who was criticised by the BMJ in 2017 for giving an unrealistic expectation of the primary care provision because he will always make home visits at a moment's notice. There is an episode when Pedro Pony coughs three times and Dr. Brown Bear goes under blue light signal to get them to give him some coughs.
Well, I mean, at the moment, that might have been apt. So, well, you know.
But the one who does all the work is Miss Rabbit. Hmm. And at various points, she has been a bus driver, a shop assistant, a firefighter, a librarian, a helicopter pilot, a nurse, a ticket seller. And clearly she's working on the gig economy, probably cash in hand. Mm-hmm. But very unreliable work. And she is having to cover for everyone else. Now, I've been trying to think about why this may have evolved, this society of government, and I think there's two options. Either this is set in a sort of slightly futuristic post-pandemic world where we've just got used to working from home and not doing much, perhaps, you know, after an outbreak of swine flu or something. Mm. The other option comes from the fact that every family only has one child in each generation. Peppa, for instance, and her brother George, two generations. But normally pigs would have litters of about a dozen.
Mm.
So it's my theory that the families have all sold off the rest of their children to allow them to have this luxurious lifestyle of very little work.
Okay, quite controversial there.
Perhaps for medical. So there's a character called Mr. Potato, who's a very shadowy figure, who's a bit of an exercise fanatic. I reckon Mr. Potato has bought all their children, rented them out to the Piers Gaveston Society or something.
Yeah.
And the only one who won't play ball are the rabbits, and that's why the rabbits are having to do all the work.
So that kind of implies that we need some kind of inquiry into this, because if it's being presented as an idyllic world, but actually there's really an underworld going on in which sort of pig babies are being sold off in order to lavish this lifestyle, I mean, yeah, you need a serious inquiry into all of this.
The ONS needs to look at why when the average size of a pig litter, according to Pig World magazine, is 12.9, there's only one child in each litter, according to Mrs. Pig. She's clearly hiding something.
I love how you both went to sort of inquiries, because I was thinking, imagine the Netflix series about the children that had been abandoned, the sort of dark, gritty reboot. Although, given what you've just said, Patrick, maybe it should sort of be a sitcom like 12.9 Children or something.
Gavin.
Sorry.
Patrick, just to talk about something serious, though, I mean, even the Prime Minister slightly alluded to this, but there are some criticisms of Peppa Pig and the way in which he's portrayed, the hapless father and all of that. Do we actually need somebody to look into the sort of the parenting there, into, you know, developing better role models? Is he being wasted in his role?
Well, he is a bit of a duffer. He's also very smug. He, one of his catchphrases is, "I am a bit of an expert." So I don't think Mr. Gove would like him very much. But the thing is, although he says he's an expert, he's not. He tries to hang a picture up and he knocks the wall down. Mm. So yes, I think he could do with some parenting classes. And you can see why Labour wanted to get them involved in Sure Start, not so much looking after the children, but educating parents. But they're also, they're well-meaning. I mean, you don't go and jump in your muddy puddles without some daddy pig saying, remember to put your Wellington boots on. He's very careful to say that every time.
I mean, if we're like looking for the sort of budding IFG researchers of the future, are there other TV shows as well that we think really bring out people who are well knowledgeable about governments, who'd understand the sort of basic tenets and so forth? Where else should we be looking for our children to watch to understand the sort of government and how it all works out? I'm always thinking of the Smurfs and, you know, the, again, development of an idyllic society, albeit one that it seems to be completely dominated by men with only one particular female.
Yeah, they poor old Smurfette.
Yeah, yeah.
I was always perplexed as a child with Trumpton because they seemed to manage to have a seven-man fire station with Pew Pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert Dibble and Grubb, and, of course, the unnamed fire chief. And yet all they ever did was get cats out of the mayor's tree. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we need to look at sort of local government staffing decisions there in Trumpton and whether the taxes are really being spent efficiently.
Mm. Yeah. What about the other two of you? Have you any childhood memories that perhaps led you to the career that you've chosen today?
Well, I think for me it was the sort of Gerry Anderson puppet shows and Thunderbirds in particular about... I suppose that the positive view of that is, you know, people working together across the globe to stop bad things happening and support one another. Although through an Institute for Government lens, it does feel like sort of outsourcing vital functions of the state to a small family who live on an island somewhere,
yeah,
which perhaps isn't the strongest message that we want for effective government.
But in their defence, they did have a ginormous screen on which they could show lots of, you know, charts and pictures and so forth. And that's quite in vogue at the moment. So
exactly.
They were ahead of their time.
Totally.
Yeah. Alice, what about you?
So something that's really stayed with me, a frankly disturbing amount, is a very particular episode of The Magic Roundabout, very much the old edition of The Magic Roundabout, not the kind of modern one, where they have some kind of competition to decide that they're going to put a sign up in Magic Roundabout World, and each of the characters nominates a kind of different sign to put up. And it's all very nice and they've all got their own interests. I think the problem is it's not really clear. All the signs are doing very different things. So it's not really clear why do they only want one sign and what are they trying to achieve with this? Because, you know, there are signs about like banning chirping birds versus trains. Very different. Mm. And then, as I recall it, there's actually no vote and everything is decided by Zebedee. And that's very odd. It's just what Zebedee wants. There's no accountability there. There's no scrutiny.
I feel like this
there.
Is giving us such an insight into your obsession with Parliament.
I mean, totally. I was also going to say, because it was originally done in French and then dubbed in English, do we think it's also...
Oh, stop showing off.
Do we think it's also a comment on the inability of the UK body politic to translate European ideas into a British setting?
No.
Fine. I mean, that's a long read that I would start reading. I'm not sure I'd finish reading it, Gavin.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there'd be much to write beyond what that one paragraph at the beginning, to be honest. I think I'd run out of ideas very quickly.
All right. Well, Gavin, turning to you last but not least, I think this entire podcast concept is probably therapy for you. And in particular, a rant that you've been working on for, well, some years now. So take it away.
So the sort of fictional universe that I think tells us a lot about our real world is, of course, the James Bond universe, where top technology has always played a really big role in Bond films, whether it's Aston Martin ejector seats or portable autogyros or exploding pens. And I think one of the things that we can see in that universe is tech solutionism, the idea that, you know, you can forget objectives and policy options and everything else, an app, more data, more technology, some over-elaborate new super weapon will solve all of our problems. And in that way, it sort of talks a lot to the real world. I think they've had to resort to that in some of the films in a slightly different way as well. You know, Die Another Day, I think all of the technology in that was just trying to cover up for the terrible acting, writing and directing. But that sort of particular issue of tech solutionism, data solutionism, probably reaches an all-time high. There's a niche octopusy reference for you there. In Spectre. Which is obviously one of the more recent Bond films, the fourth, and I think by some distance, the worst film of the Daniel Craig era.
Really? I mean, that's quite controversial in itself.
I know. Everybody says Quantum of Solace. Quantum of Solace is a much, much better film than Spectre.
I mean,
Yes.
Okay. All right, Gavin, your time. You go for it.
So turning to Spectre, it is, as our colleague Jill Rutter once memorably said, a film about botched arm's length body reform.
Yeah.
Because one of the key characters is Max Denby, played by Andrew Scott, who goes from Fleabag's hot priest to Spectre's ice-cold functionary, who becomes head of this newly merged MI5 and MI6. He wants to bring the intelligence services out of the Dark Ages and into the light by gathering all the data he possibly can. Now, Bond and his various associates are quite sceptical of Denby. I wonder what Denby's going to turn out to be by the end of the film. A villain, possibly? Who knows? And in fact, Tanner, M's chief of staff, disparages him as a classic Whitehall Mandarin because he once wrote a paper on drones. He's never actually served in the field. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Now, that's a trope as old as the hills in the Bond films, the sort of desk-based bureaucrat who doesn't understand what life is really like in the field. It happens to Ralph Fiennes' M in Skyfall. It certainly happens to Judi Dench's M in GoldenEye, where she's disparaged as the evil queen of numbers, an accountant. She's kind of new public management and data-driven daftness made flesh in the security services. I mean, how would you actually go about setting impact measures for James Bond's performance? Actually, it's probably best not to think about that too deeply, given how James Bond probably measures his own performance in various scenarios. Anyway, so Denby and our classic arch-villain Blofeld, whom obviously Denby clearly isn't actually really working for, honest, is the sort of embodiment of this tech and data solutionism. He thinks getting all of this data, specifically from 9 of the world's biggest intelligence agencies that he can sort of watch and listen to all of the time, will solve all of the world's problems. He thinks that the writing's on the wall for the traditional way of doing things. But I think what's really, really telling about that is any of his surveillance successes in the film only happen when he already knows what questions he's trying to answer, what it is he's actually looking for, and when he's actually got a much smaller data set that allows him to answer the questions that he's asking. Now, of course, M points out that for all of the data and all of the tech, the agent in the field is still vital in analysing all of that information and deciding whether or not to pull the trigger. So domain expertise, that human decision-making, still really matters for all of the drones and cameras and bugs and international surveillance tech operations. It does all still come down to human decision-making. Data's not neutral. It's not infallible. And there's a scene where Bond comes to Blofeld's sort of supervillain lair. And Blofeld's asked, what is this place? And Blofeld says, it's information. Information is all, is it not? And Blofeld asks Bond, well, why did you come to my lair? Bond says he came to kill Blofeld. Blofeld thought Bond came there to die. As Bond says, it's all a matter of perspective.
Okay, so what you're basically saying to me, to paraphrase, is that people who understand data are definitely part of a shadow organization who are trying to take down the world. Is that right?
Called the Institute for Government. I think I'm probably making the case that the next Bond film as well needs to have the Information Commissioner in a really key role to make sure that all of the surveillance information is being used properly.
Well, I think, or you could be making the point that Bond seriously needs to understand how to use Excel and Inkscape. And going back to the impact measurement, I do think, you know, in the net zero world in which we live, somebody needs to look at the carbon contribution that James Bond's sort of jetting across the world sort of 3 or 4 times in every film must be costing, and whether or not there's a much better way of actually getting him, you know, or getting somebody else to the right place at the right time. Because that's a lot of flying around the world very quickly.
It is. And I think, I mean, one of the solutions, or well, actually, one of the other things that the sort of Daniel Craig Bond films consider is that sort of changing nature of warfare, because actually, for all that Bond still jets off to all these exotic locales, so much of the conflict is kind of moving online. It's now sort of, you know, cyber threats and things like that. And I think the sort of Daniel Craig Bond films actually have a really complex relationship with technology. Bond is trying to find his place in this world. And there's quite an, I suppose, a surprising running theme through Skyfall, and it ends up in No Time to Die as well, the latest Bond film, which again is all about the unintended consequences of technology, which is JMW Turner's painting, The Fighting Temeraire. That's not something you often expect to hear in relation to a Bond film, but there's the great scene in Skyfall where Bond meets Ben Whishaw's Q for the first time, and they're in the National Gallery. They're looking at this painting, and Q's meditating thoughtfully upon it, that, you know, it shows the passage of time. This old warship, the Temeraire, has been ravaged. It's being towed off by a steamboat, the kind of more modern technology, meaning that the Temeraire has to be scrapped, whereas Bond just sees a bloody big ship. And there's quite a nice twist at the end of the film where Bond has sort of found his place again. He's in M's office, and the painting on the wall is of the Battle of Trafalgar. And obviously HMS Victory is the kind of focal point of this painting. But there alongside it is the Temeraire. It's kind of a sign that Bond does still have a place in this modern world. His sort of, you know, old-fashioned British bluntness actually may still be able to play a part in the modern world as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you've watched these movies far too many times.
I think that's almost certainly true. But I think it does raise genuinely interesting questions about the, you know, the role of intelligence agencies in that world. And we could even really pretentiously extend that whole thing to the ship of state. Is it adrift on the cyber seas, or does it still have a role before it's towed off by whatever the government equivalent of a steamship is?
Oh, very mate. Good.
Yeah.
I know. It's been a long year. What can I say?
Patrick, Bond fan, not Bond fan?
I have at least watched the Bond films. I liked the latest one quite a lot, actually. I think I'm alone in thinking Skyfall was pretty awful. It was far too long. But I was just thinking about Gavin watching all this with diligence. It's nothing compared to an Oxford academic called Andrew Sillett, one of those people I know on Twitter, who at the start of the pandemic decided he would watch Die Another Day once a week until the pandemic was over.
Yes.
He eventually, after a year, decided that was enough, but he did watch it 52 times.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I'm just amazed how little paperwork Bond seems to do.
Yeah.
I mean, well, the film's long enough, so maybe he does that after the film stops. But given all the waste of material and technology, as you say, the cars he trashes, the HR issues with his behaviour towards sort of female spies and stuff,
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of sitting in meetings.
I feel some freedom of information requests coming on personally.
Yeah, and all the expense accounts that he seems to run up, all the rest of it, yeah.
But Gavin talked about the environmental impact, and I thought, well, let's go back to From Russia With Love, where he travels on the Orient Express, which, okay, isn't cheap, but is at least going to save the planet.
Yeah.
Although you might get jumped by a Smirsch or Spectre henchman. That's the only problem with travelling on a train.
Yeah, you have to look out to see whether he has red wine with fish.
And well, that actually... I mean, all this jet-setting around the world, do we ever see him get on a commercial flight, or does he have his own, like, private jet that he goes on?
I'm ashamed to say I think he is on a British Airways flight in Die Another Day when he comes back to London and The Clash's London Calling is playing.
Okay, fine. All right, well, it wouldn't be Christmas without a lively debate about everyone's favourite topic. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? And the answer is yes, definitely, and one of the best. So moving on.
52% of you girls say no.
Well, they're wrong. Christmas movies. Patrick, I believe you have thoughts.
I do have thoughts. Well, I mean, my favourite, which I watch every year, it isn't so much a movie, but I always love to watch the BBC's Box of Delights. Which was on in 1984 when I was eight, and it's got snow and clergy being scrabbled and steam trains and nice kids in tweeds speaking politely. So I love that. But I'm going to talk now briefly about It's a Wonderful Life, which I also adore, the black and white James Stewart film, because to me, this sums up the essence of what David Cameron was getting at with The Big Society. Mm. You'll remember the plot is that he is a very much a hometown community man, whose family business is in terrible trouble when his absent-minded Uncle Billy manages to lose $8,000 inside a newspaper. And it's all going to go under, and Jimmy Stewart considers committing suicide until his guardian angel shows what would happen to the world if he wasn't alive. And everyone then, spoiler alert, in the community comes in with their money to bail him out. And it's lovely, and the angel gets his wings and all that.
Yeah.
But I then discovered a piece that Michael Gove wrote in 1997.
Oh, really?
When he was a Times journalist, that completely poo-poos this. It's a fine piece of writing, of course, but Gove goes on to say that the real hero of It's a Wonderful Life isn't George Bailey, Jimmy Stewart's character, but it's some old man Potter, who is the the wealthy banker who's holding over the edge of the precipice, who describes him as a Pat Buchanan type, who wants to create this sort of strip lights, speakeasies, atmospheres, cheap drinking, freewheeling. This is far more attractive, writes Gove, than the communitarian dreamland of Bedford Falls, just as liberty is always preferable to constriction. And goes on to say that effectively George Bailey has restrained his horizons, his squandered his spirit by just being the small man, and that America does better when it thinks big. And so, therefore, we're quite wrong to think that George Bailey is a good thing, and instead, Old Man Potter is who we should bow down before.
Ah, interesting thoughts from Gove there. I wonder, whether he'd sort of take the same view now if he sort of reassessed it. You know, all the goodwill that the movie sort of brings out in people is interesting, because one of my favourite movies is Gremlins, which obviously is a bit of a play on It's a Wonderful Life, and obviously references the movie in it. And actually, I found out recently some of my colleagues hadn't even seen it, which I find quite appalling. I kind of think that, you know, this is a bit of a lesson for us in devolution and local government, because you see there a sort of, you know, a great desire amongst the community build towards tackling issues on their own, and yet without the tools available to do so. There's very little intervention from the outside world. There's no evidence whatsoever when series of people start being killed and the town gets completely trashed of anyone from anywhere beyond the town limits coming in to rescue them. You know, it's all about what they have to do. You've got the sort of key characters, many of whom could be councillors, all there trying to sort of fix matters. And in the end, you have to have somebody who's effectively putting themselves forward as a bit of a metro mayor, who has to come in and start inventing, you know, innovative ways in which to kill all the gremlins, focusing obviously in the end on the municipal swimming pool, which is, you know, as always, a very sort of key fixture in terms of local government spending, and one of the things people are always worried about, funding. So is it a cry for help, perhaps, for local governments, and a cry for more devolution? I think it could be.
Gremlins as a levelling up parable is certainly not something I was expecting to hear today, I must say.
No, no. And I, you know, just thought of it myself as I was listening to Patrick there. All right, Gavin, what about you? What's your favourite Christmas movie? What will you be watching in the next couple of weeks?
That's a very good question, actually. I do have a sneaking, well, not a sneaking like, a very unapologetic like for Home Alone, which is, of course, again, in a very different way, the sort of story of the downtrodden rising up and defeating the forces of the sort of older, greater, bigger forces of evil. And again, ties very nicely to Succession, given that Roman Roy is in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alice, what about you? What will you be watching?
So I'm very much the kind of Michael Owen of IFG, which is I've seen about like five films in my life.
I would say, which is?
I mean, Air Force One is a film for all seasons, Kath. Yeah. It's not explicitly Christmassy. It's not explicitly not Christmassy. But as someone who's very interested in kind of Anglo-American relations, obviously the scene in Love Actually, where Prime Minister Hugh Grant stands up to President Billy Bob Thornton, I think it is fascinating, but also to me seems to represent an absolutely hideous failure by the Foreign Office, who apparently have not briefed Prime Minister Hugh Grant at all on what the President is like. And that is just fundamentally a huge oversight, and one that may well end up having huge ramifications.
I mean, Love Actually, more generally, I think in its perception of, or its presentation of Number 10 and the working of government, is a little bit missing.
You say that. I suppose in that it's a bit of a mess of various different storylines of variable quality, which they're trying to bring together as a whole. It does feel a bit like a manifesto.
That's true, I suppose. It obviously also contains, lots of people like the movie. I can watch it. I have some affection for it, but I cannot forgive it now for the scene, showing the cards outside. I can't even remember who it is.
It's Keira Knightley's place.
Yeah. Not least because for some reason doing the rounds was a picture of Boris Johnson doing that in the last election. And it seems that it's now something that everyone's got to do at some point is recreate that scene. And it's becoming a bit too much. Okay, well, that's it. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Many thanks for listening at home and many thanks to Alice Lilly, Gavin Freegard, and especially Patrick Kidd. If you like this podcast, do check out our other slightly more serious podcasts at IFG Live, Inside Briefing's sister podcast. There's loads there to keep you entertained if you're isolating or just want to escape the in-laws. And it's all on Spotify, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. And do leave us a review. It's Christmas, so perhaps make it a happy one. And check out our website, instituteforgovernment.org.uk, for all the IFG work we've done this year and will be doing next. In the meantime, I hope we provided you with a bit of an escape from all the politics, which has, at times, felt stranger than fiction. See you next year and happy Christmas.